Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is Ollie Kellett. Ollie's major work, entitled Crossroad Blues, has been exhibited several times, once again this week, and has just been published as a book. It's the culmination of several years of travelling to cities, mainly in North and South America, and making large-scale photographs of people standing at crossroads. They're taken from high vantage points so that the subjects are both framed and dwarfed by the surrounding urban buildings. The title's taken from the name of a track by the blues singer Robert Johnson, who, according to legend, sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads for musical talent. I'll be talking to Ollie about the concept for his series, which earned him the Rose Award for Photography at the 2018 Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. Other awards have followed. And as we'll hear, he's done more conceptual series since. I spoke to him from his home in Hastings.
Ollie Kellett, welcome to the Considering Art podcast.
Thank you.
Has photography been a long-held ambition?
Yes. I got a camera when I was about 15 or 16, and I felt like at the time I lived in a small village in Northamptonshire, and it just allowed me quite a lot of freedom to wander around with some kind of purpose, perhaps. And it continued as an interest. And it still does in one way or another. So I'm glad it's progressed to slightly more than an interest.
Yeah, you did graphic design at Central St. Martin's. Why was that?
Yeah, that's right. So as I said, I grew up in Northamptonshire and I had an excellent art teacher called John Dutfield. And at some point during my A-levels, he suggested I went to St. Martin's, which I'd never heard of. And that's what I did. I applied there to go on foundation and I got in, which I was very happy about. Actually, as an interesting aside here, my grandfather applied and got into the Royal College of Art, but the Second World War broke out. And so he had his place, but he never managed to go. And because the war dragged on a bit, obviously, he never actually went in the end. Because when it had finished, he went back to, well, he started running a tobacconist. But anyway, that's a small thing.
It
was quite a big deal to go to art college for my mother, actually. And when I got that letter, acceptance letter, she was over the moon.
It was her father, was it?
It was her father, yeah.
Yeah, so you fulfilled a family ambition there.
Maybe, yeah. And he was an excellent painter. He painted his whole life.
Oh, really?
Which is what I thought I would do, actually. So, yeah, I went to St. Martin's to do my foundation, where you do all sorts of different disciplines. You kind of do a bit of architecture, a bit of fashion, painting, fine art, graphic design. And I honestly was convinced I was going to be a painter.
You say that because I saw you posted on Instagram a picture of yourself, I think as a 19-year-old. You were painting copies of Renaissance paintings on the pavement. I just wondered whether that you were a frustrated painter.
You know, I am a frustrated painter, and I think I'll somehow get back to painting in the end, but I keep trying and it never works out. So the painting on the street was what I did in the weekends and in school holidays when I was not at college, and I did it for a couple of years after that as well. It was very lucrative, really. It was an excellent thing to make money as I was studying. I mean, I can say I paid my way through art college through painting on the street, but that wasn't what I studied in the end. I think on the foundation, I didn't particularly enjoy the fine art discipline on the foundation course. It was very conceptual, and although I liked conceptual work now, I think at the time I wasn't quite ready for it. So I went and did the graphic design discipline instead, and then ended up specifically working in a kind of a small niche of coming up with ideas for adverts, which consisted of just a pen and a piece of paper and trying to come up with a way or a feeling to advertise something. And I quite liked that. It was all about a lot of ideas very quickly, And I got on quite well with that.
You wrote scripts for TV adverts, didn't you?
Yeah, so then after I left St. Martin's, I was lucky enough to get a job in an ad agency quite quickly. And when you leave university, art college, you really have to quite quickly work out how you're going to make some money. And as this was almost handed to me on a plate, I just went for it. And I did 3 years in a few different advertising agencies. And while I was doing that, I was also photographing out and about, walking around with my camera out on the streets in London. So it was the two were living side by side. And then after 3 years of working in the ad agency, I left full time to kind of pursue this idea of an artist.
One of the first series you did, Ollie, was entitled Paradise, where you took photographs of street names called Paradise. What was the idea behind that?
I lived near a place called Everest, and as I walked past it or drove past it, it always gave me a bit of a smile that somebody had the audacity to name this collection of 1970s bungalows Everest. It made me wonder what other places are kind of named, promising so much but delivering so little. And so I started to have a look online, and this was at the beginning of Google Maps, going all the way back to about 2008, this was, or maybe even earlier. When you could just type in paradise into Google Maps and it would show you where paradise was. I started off with all sorts of words like Prospect Place, Eden, Utopia, and then eventually narrowed it down to just one word, paradise, because I felt like everybody understands through centuries of art and music the idea of paradise to what it represents. And it became just a process of going to these locations and setting up my camera, which was an old-fashioned 5x4-inch camera, and taking a picture.
And what were you trying to achieve by just people who got above themselves, so to speak, in the way they name streets?
Well, it's interesting you say that, actually, because although I wasn't sure how these residential streets were named, after a bit of research, I realized that these streets are named by the housing companies who develop the land and build these houses. And you can sell a house for more if the street is named something aspirational. And then the project took a slightly sinister turn once I'd found that out. But essentially the whole idea is one of interest. I was quite keen to, I just left my job in the advertising agency, and I was keen to get out and remind myself what England looked like, not just London. And it was more of a conceptual idea, starting with an idea, this idea of paradise, and traveling just to complete the work. I think I went to about 50 or 60 places all over the country called Paradise, Paradise Street, Paradise Yard, Paradise Road. And then there are a few just pure paradise. I think my favorite is just north of the M25, and it's an industrial estate. I mean, quite beautiful in its own right, but it's just called Paradise, not Paradise Street, not Paradise Close, just Paradise. And it's just one of those wonderful places. You can't help but smile. It's called Paradise, and it's an industrial estate, a very nondescript gray. But I guess I like that juxtaposition of the two things colliding.
Yeah. Let's talk about your major work now, Crossroad Blues. You've taken many, many shots in North and South America, mainly, of people standing at crossroads, thinking about what they're going to do. It's a kind of metaphor that we'll talk about in a minute. But I gather that the genesis of this was actually you went over to the United States to cover the US election of 2016, that's one between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And what aspects were you trying to cover, and how did it develop into what it eventually turned out to be?
In the UK, the media was going crazy for this election. And I felt like it started 6 months at least before the actual election date in November, that every front page was to do with Donald Trump. And I don't think I'd ever seen anything like it. And I mean, it frustrated me a bit because I felt like there was so much news happening in the UK in terms of Brexit as well, that I wanted to see what it was all about. Was America really falling apart? So I traveled there in late 2016, a week before the election. And I wanted to kind of have a feel of what the atmosphere was like. And I think when I arrived, I was quite surprised by how little interest there was from Americans in their own election. And what they really wanted to talk about was Brexit, which was completely bizarre because that's where I'd come from. Mm. I even had a chat with a taxi driver at one point where all he wanted to talk about was Brexit, not his own elections in his, you know, backyard. So once I got there, this idea that I was going to make a body of work went away almost as quick as it began. But I was there for 10 days. I was there throughout the election, and I did try to make some work. It was a collection of portraits and city scenes all in downtown Los Angeles. I wasn't really sure what I was looking for. It was quite an organic process of just walking around and letting the city kind of affect the direction I took. And at the end of the 10 days, I hadn't really achieved much, but there was one picture which resonated with me, and it was of a lady waiting at a crossroads. There was beautiful evening light on her, and she was standing there absolutely still. And I kept coming back to this idea that she was standing at a crossroads, but she was representing something much bigger than just herself at the time. She was representing the whole of America standing at this crossroads. And in a week's time, the election will happen. And, you know, everybody's polarizing views will be made at the ballot box or whatever. And at that point, I traveled home again after the election. I felt like there was something in this picture of crossroads. So I booked another trip to another city in America. And at this point, the project really was still around trying to create a body of work about the divisions in America. But the crossroads kept cropping up. And I found myself over the months and the trips that I took that I began to purely focus on crossroads. And the project shifted from the idea of America being at a crossroads to what crossroads represent to the individual. Mm. And the saying that, oh, they're at a crossroads in their life became more and more important.
So you went out into the streets looking for people at crossroads. What was the ideal scenario for you? What time of day and a particular positioning, that sort of thing?
The crossroads really developed from a wider idea. And I would spend a few days, maybe just a couple of days, when I would arrive in a city, just walking around. I would have my camera with me, but it's a slow camera. It's on a tripod. It's got a manual shutter release. And so I wouldn't really waste a lot of time if I didn't think pictures would work. And I would walk around for a couple of days trying to scout out these locations, ideally where the light will hit at a specific time, where I can get some elevation, and where there's just enough people that come by, but not too many that it becomes crowded. Because over the time, I really got used to focusing in on single individuals in that moment of contemplation. So I would, once I'd found a space, I would return for 2 or 3 days, sometimes 4 days, trying to get a picture. And it just became a process of arriving and setting up my camera, and just waiting, really. It's about waiting, and it's about walking and waiting.
You must have a lot of patience.
I do have patience. But some of the pictures really came together very quickly as well. And in this process of walking around, suddenly something will come together. And in fact, the front cover of the book is a picture on Grand Avenue in Chicago. And it's of this red brick building. And the light on it was just so incredible because the light was being reflected off a golden building. So it was already a sunset, but it was almost like a double sunset because the natural orangey golden sunset was being reflected again in a golden building onto a red building. So, but that came together within a couple of minutes, I saw this pool of light in the distance. I honestly ran the kind of three blocks until I arrived on the corner. I set the camera up and made sure it was all in focus, and then just waited a couple of minutes, knowing that the light would move around incredibly quickly, and just figure came and stood there, waited a minute, and I took the picture. So sometimes these pictures came together in a matter of minutes, but sometimes it was days. There's not really one right or wrong way of doing it. You wait and take enough pictures until you think you've got something meaningful.
One of the interesting things about the series is that the people in it are generally very small scale compared to the huge cityscape around them. Why did you choose to put that distance?
I chose the cities based on them feeling like a almost generic urban space. I wasn't keen on big logos or anything that would distract from it being about the individual. But I wanted the individual to also feel dwarfed by this city they're in, almost inconsequential.
I mean, it's interesting, I think, that of the contrast that you get with the anonymity of the cityscape. As you say, there's no logos, there's no obvious buildings that you'd know, and the personal human making those choices at crossing the road.
That's right. I almost wanted that these decisions of which direction to take to feel really quite monumental, and that's why I like to have so much space around the individual. It almost gives them so much choice as to which decision, which path to choose. That's why I'm quite far away from them. But the prints of this work are also big, and they're big so that you can see the expressions on the faces of these people. So although they're quite small in the frame, there's enough detail there for you to understand what's going on inside their heads, I like to feel.
Have you got any particular favourites?
Actually, I do have a couple of favourites. So I had been photographing Crossroads in London before I made the trip to America, but usually larger crowds of people. And then I travelled for 4 years taking pictures all over the world for this work. And then eventually I went back to London, and I felt like I'd learned something over the 4 years about how to photograph. And I went back to these locations where I had been previously photographing 4 years earlier, and suddenly it all came together. And the light was perfect, and the correct people turned up. But there is a picture of a girl in a red jumper, and she is just outside Bank Tube Station, stopped in the middle of the road on a small traffic island. But she's there, and she has her eyes closed. Everybody around her is moving. You can see everybody moving around, but she's there completely stationary, her head slightly up, tilted upwards, and her eyes are closed. And I'd love to know what went through her mind to stop there, to close her eyes and just wait. Well, this is an interesting thing about why I took so many pictures in America, and it's because of the don't walk sign. Because in England, I'm so used to just crossing the road in between cars. You don't really wait to be told when to cross the road, you just cross. But in America, you have to be told when to cross, and sometimes these in enormous roads, you know, you're waiting there for 3 or 4 minutes, and it's just so much time for you to stop for a second and think and to look around and appreciate things. And we don't have that in London. But how the work grew for me was, how do you know the correct decision to make at any time in your life? Which is the right path to take? Which door do you choose? These pictures allude to that idea. You almost have unlimited choice, but how do you know which is the correct path to take?
There's a certain cinematic quality, isn't there, in your works? And especially when, if you add the bit of narrative, like the woman you were saying with her eyes closed.
The use of light in the work it's very much about emphasizing the individual. If I was to take these pictures at midday when the sun is coming from above, the entire background and foreground kind of blends into one big indiscriminate space. But if you can use the light to make these individuals stand out from the background, the work just comes to life. And as I said earlier, it's all about the individuals. So I was just using the daylight to my advantage, really. But I'm also very happy to get up before dawn. I'm very happy to walk around. I'm very happy to wait. So yeah, I guess that's where the cinematic quality comes from.
There was one particular one. It's a classic Cartier-Bresson decisive moment picture. That's the one in Illinois Street in Chicago, where you've caught a woman in a very narrow street. You've caught her in light, but she's silhouetted against the white background on the street. You know the one I mean?
I know which one you mean, yeah. And that was when I mentioned a minute ago about spending 4 days. That was one of those moments. So there was a ton of roadworks happening on that street. So what she is walking across are those enormous, really thick sheet metal things they put over the road so that the traffic could continue. And I think there was 4 of them side by side. And I went back for 4 days, each time trying to get the perfect picture, whatever the perfect picture means. But and eventually I went back on the 5th day and the roadworks had been completed. So those metal sheets on the floor weren't there anymore. And then I was content that that moment will never be repeated. Although no moments would ever be repeated, I felt like it could be done again, but this time, because the landscape had changed, it can't be repeated.
Have you learned anything about human behavior by looking at people in urban streets?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would say that I'm not sure anyone knows the correct path to take. I don't know how else to elaborate or answer that.
You've included a couple of shots of actual crowds in the streets. There's one outside Stratford Station in London, very different, obviously, to those single people standing at the crossroads. What was the idea behind putting crowds of people in there?
So this is a picture that's in the exhibition, but it's not one that's in the book. Originally, I'd been photographing these crowds in London, and I wanted that to translate to other places all over the world. But in that time, and as the project progressed, I found myself identifying more with the single figure. But within these crowds, there's always a few people looking up, lost in their thoughts. And that's the feeling I try to get when I photograph the individual. So although there are a few pictures of crowds, within those crowds, there are still the same individuals looking up, looking for some guidance, looking for some answers, I like to believe. So I feel like even though there are crowd pictures, within the crowds, you can still find those moments.
You can still be lonely even in a crowd.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice idea. That's true.
When you were first sorting out the concept, had you looked at other people who had used crossroads for any reason in their art?
The project is named after the song by Robert Johnson called Crossroad Blues. And essentially that boils down to somebody selling their soul at a crossroads to the devil. And what I liked about that was alluding to the idea that there are correct paths to take, whichever direction that may be. And that was what I was trying to achieve with the crossroads pictures. That song was an inspiration. But in terms of other artists, visual artists, not especially. I mean, I think I'm inspired by the romance of these American road trips from the 60s and 70s, the Joel Sternfelds and more recent photographers. But I've never been particularly interested in creating a narrative work where it comes to life in the book form. I'm far more interested in the individual image.
This Crossroad Blues series took several years. How did you know when to finish it?
I actually knew when it was finished when I took a picture in Rio, and it's the last picture in the book. And I'd been in Rio for a few days and I hadn't taken any successful pictures. And on the penultimate day, almost right next to where I was staying, there was a pool of light that was being reflected off the glass buildings. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. And I set my camera up and waited. And nobody came and stood in the correct place. But I knew this was almost my only chance of coming away from Rio with a good picture. So the next day, on my last day, I went back and I set my camera up. And when the light's been reflected off some windows onto the pavement, you only have about half an hour before it moves into the road or away. And there was a moment where a couple walked towards this pool of light. He looked up, saw something, his finger towards the sky, and then told his partner also to look up. And his finger is perfectly vertical. And she is shielding her eyes and looking up as well. And kind of all of the art history is tied up in this, that one gesture of pointing to the sky. You have the John the Baptist paintings. You have the Raphael School of Athens picture. And over the course of making this work, I'd been trying to educate myself more in these bigger spiritual existential ideas. And I felt it all came together in that one gesture of him pointing to the sky. And it's the only picture where I've ever taken one and immediately gone back to my Airbnb to back it up. Normally I would continue photographing, but I felt like it was so important that I immediately went back, put it on my computer and backed it up multiple times. And I just knew it was the end of the project.
Let's talk about one of your projects now, Ollie, Life Drawings, in which you photograph the circular marks that you find on the inside of cups and bowls that have been formed over the years. Again, what was the genesis behind that?
This project began in 2019, just as the Crossroad Blues pictures were finishing. And I was desperate not to travel anymore. I felt like I'd been very privileged to be able to travel the world. I'd spent a lot of time away from my family. And all I really wanted to do was stay at home and be a bit more of a family person. I don't know if my wife wanted me to be that, but that's what I became for a bit longer. I've been reading lots of Eastern philosophy, Zen Buddhism, Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching. So I feel like I was in tune to that way of thinking a bit more. And my kids were eating bowls of ice cream. And the way that they repetitively scraped around the bowl to get the last bits of ice cream, I thought was interesting as I washed the bowls up. And I saw these silvery lines in the bowls. And I looked at them and thought, they look just like drawings. They look just like graphite on paper. And I thought, this is interesting. They'd make fascinating drawings if I could somehow get them out of the three-dimensional bowl space and onto a two-dimensional piece of paper. And then I just became obsessed with trying to find more cups and bowls that have been marked over years and years by the spoon, by the stirring motion, by the scraping, and then how I would go about trying to get these marks off the cups and bowls and onto a piece of paper.
What? So you then drew them?
So they're not drawings, they're photographs. And I would set them up with a camera overhead and on a potter's wheel, and I set up a flash. But what it meant was I could only photograph a sliver of a cup or a bowl at once. And this is because there's so many reflections in a white cup or a bowl that you can never photograph the entire thing at once. If you imagine that I'm photographing each one like a slice of pizza, so each time I'm photographing a slice, and then I would rotate the potter's wheel an inch and photograph exactly the same space, but moved round an inch. And that's because I could find at least a small sliver of the cup or the bowl that hadn't got a reflection or a deep shadow on it.
Right.
And then it became a process of stitching these pictures together, and sometimes as much as 90 pictures to create these pictures of the inside of a cup or a bowl.
Right. That's quite an ingenious way of doing it.
Well, it was not without trial and error.
But again, what's the concept behind that?
I was trying to find this idea of the eternal in the transitory. So making a cup of tea is just the most commonplace thing you can do. And as you stir, you create each day a small mark. And over years, you've created an entire drawing, I call it, inside this cup. But once it's photographed, it's suddenly becoming these circular themes that look like Japanese Enzo drawings. So you're dealing with this idea of eternity, of never ending, but it's been created in an absolute instant. And I thought that was interesting.
You've done a sort of similar thing with soap dishes, haven't you, which is a series that you're currently involved in. You photograph bits of soap on different soap dishes over a day. Again, what's the concept?
So, again, the soap drawings began in 2019, and they began at the same time as the life drawings, the photographs I was taking inside cups and bowls. So I was very in tune to this idea of looking at drawings, and I was looking for an idea that I could have more of a studio-based practice. I felt like I was done with traveling. And I think I'd got tired of this idea of chance in work. And photography, especially the photography that I was working on, you're continually reliant on chance to have a successful picture. And over the years of making Crossroad Blues, I got a bit disheartened with this idea of chance. And I just wanted to eliminate it completely from the work. And again, it came back to this Eastern philosophical idea that continually working towards something, and is it a recipe for contentment? And with the Crossroad pictures, I was continually trying to produce a better picture, and a better picture, a more interesting picture. And I felt like perhaps a bit of a victim to the work. Maybe that's not the correct.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Okay. So I was keen to eliminate this idea of chance in the work, and I wanted to create some work that was almost entirely the same day after day, because I wanted to see how doing something repetitive every day can affect your contentment. So I've done this for 4 years now, and I begin with an entire bar of soap on a soap dish, and throughout the days it gets smaller and smaller as it gets used, and I draw it each day. And then at the end, I choose another soap and another soap dish, and I repeat it every day. So I'm drawing the same drawing effectively anything between kind of 20 and 50 days, depending on the size of the soap. I now have about 200 soap dishes and about 200 soaps. So I have enough to keep me going forever, I think.
You have a very clean house as well, I guess.
very clean hands, yeah. And it's just about this idea of discipline and knowing what I'm going to be doing, and repetition, and seeing how it can shape a life. But what was interesting was what I loved about photography all back in 2000 when I was at art college and before, was the immediacy of photography. You could go out and you could take some pictures and it was done. And this is back in the day when you would process your film and you would print in a dark room, and there was only so much you could do to a picture. You know, it kind of worked or it didn't work. You couldn't completely manipulate it like you can now. And I liked that closure. But interestingly, that's the exact reason why I'm not so interested in photography anymore. I'm not really looking for closure in a project. I'm looking for the opposite. I'm looking for these open-ended ideas that can evolve, but essentially still stay the same.
you can see this series going on until you just get so fed up with it, or your wife chucks out all your soap dishes.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm glad I have enough that I have at least another 10 years worth of drawings to do, and who knows what it will transform into, whether I'll keep the quite rigid rules that I have now, which is I draw a 5x4 inch drawing every day under the same lighting conditions in the same position, and the idea might evolve or it might not. There's a wonderful German artist called Peter Dreher, and he painted an empty glass about 5,000 times. And when I first heard about this project, I remember the exact time and location I was, and a friend was telling me about it. He had an exhibition at the White Cube in 2018, and I hadn't seen it, and I'd never heard of him. And as my friend told me about him, it was just one of those moments of, oh, wow, just what joy to just work on something so minuscule when I'd spent the last 4 years traveling all over the world looking for these almost once-in-a-lifetime moments. And I felt like I couldn't continue. I wanted to focus on something absolutely tiny and absolutely repetitive, and I wanted to know what I was doing when I got up in the morning, instead of this almost endless searching. Well, I've now been doing this for 4 years. I don't know if I found any answers or anything, but there's definitely a contentment there.
But it's interesting that, you know, the 19-year-old who was painting on the pavements of London is now back drawing again.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting, because now I have two children. One of them is 12 and the other one is 10. And I watch what they do. And when I was the same age as my 12-year-old, I would be drawing and I would be painting. And I think at some point you just must return to those kind of primal early childhood things you do for pure enjoyment. So I'm enjoying kind of watching what they're doing now, thinking that there's a good chance that it will influence their life later on.
Very interesting. Well, thanks so much for talking, Ollie, and good luck with the book.
Thanks very much. So the book is out in January, and the exhibition opens on the 23rd of November all the way through to the beginning of March at Hackberry Fine Art in London.
Yeah, I'll put the details on the website. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Ollie Kellett. It sounds like Ollie reached his own crossroads when deciding to work more from home. Thanks for listening. This is Bob Chaundy, hoping you'll join me again next week.